Hello and welcome to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. This is one of your hosts, Colin Miller, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Rabia Chaudhry. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you, Colin?
I'm doing well. And we are also joined, as always, this season by Jennifer Leahy, a research and investigative assistant who has worked with Rabia going all the way back to the Jason Carroll series. And so, Jen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Colin. Thanks.
All right. So today we'll be talking about all things episode 10, post-conviction in the Patricia Rohr series. And Rabia and Jen, I want to start. We're introduced to a couple of new characters in this case. The first of those being Margaret Snurey, who has worked in this case for so many years, going back all the way to the original trial. And so, Rabia, what has been your experience?
I mean, okay, so, you know, when I first started working on this case and I learned about Margaret's work, and I'm like, where are all of her notes and her files? And I was pretty devastated to learn that what happened was she had, we're talking about, I don't know, more than a decade's worth of work, and she had lots and lots of boxes. But after she passed away, her husband got rid of them. And so when I think it was Tammy who went looking for them, and he got rid of them. And, you know, I can understand it. I think he was like, you know, this case consumed her and maybe killed her. I mean, like, I'm sure it didn't kill her, but you know what I mean? Like, it was like so central to her work that I think he was just like, I don't even want to look at this stuff ever again, right? And she was quite young when she passed. So in the absence of that, what we really have from Margaret is like, we have some limited documents that were given to us by Tammy, like in the file. And those are mostly the documents that Margaret managed to get through like her FOIA requests and all, you know, her interviewing. And then when we went to meet Joe Alersha, which was great. Joe Alersha, as you hear him at the end of the episode, and at least the Jen has half the files. I have the other half. I have found a folder that has, like, you know, notes from Margaret that I hadn't seen before and letters she had written. I mean, she was relentless.
Yeah, and Jen, Robbie just mentioned, I'll call him P.I. Joe, which we hear some of the audio of Robbie and you know, interacting with him. And so, Jen, what can you tell us about your experiences working with P.I. Joe in this case?
Yeah, I'm grateful he was able to meet with us like on such short notice. We were able to go right over, you know. It was pretty incredible. And he was generous with his time, was sharing the files, you know. And he remembered a lot, you know, given the amount of cases the man must work with. I can't imagine being able to retain all that, you know. So he kind of just jumped right back into it.
Yeah. Right. I mean, his, you know, obviously all these years later, and he does work a lot of cases. There were times when his details were a little bit off, but
yes.
his instinct was pretty, like, he knew where he landed on the case.
Yeah. Right. I mean, just like the fact that he like didn't have to like be like, oh, let me dig, you know, he remembered the general gist of it, you know, and then the fact that he could find these boxes of files.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, Robbie, you mentioned earlier how, unfortunately, a lot of the work that Margaret had done is now gone. You kind of start the episode revisiting Fonda Eggers, this distant relative of Patty, who was basically monitoring her activities during the time that this murder occurred. And as you know, the state is saying we don't have these files of the reporting she did. And there's a thing in the law known as an adverse inference instruction, where if a party can't produce documents in their possession, the judge can give an instruction to the jurors to draw adverse inferences from the absence of that. And that's kind of where we stand with Fonda Eggers, right? We think these records would show that Patty was in North Carolina on the day of the murder.
Yeah. You know, the Eggers thing is really, it's kind of confounding to me because I thought it was really risky that they put her on the stand. And that makes me wonder whether or not the prosecutor knew everything about Eggers or like kind of what information had been filtered to him. But, you know, at the time that Eggers was put on the stand, she testified only about like her investigation into the abuse charges. Neither Patty or her defense team knew about the surveillance. If And I'm assuming that there's only two possibilities, that either the prosecutors did not also not know. Otherwise, if they knew and they put her on the stand, I feel it would be risky because that could have been it. That could have been the end of the trial. I mean, like that she would have been the solidest alibi that Patty could have, this woman who can't stand her. Or they were confident knowing that there's no way the defense knows about it. And that's obviously problematic.
Yeah, and Jen, we know that these notes that were taken by Fonda Eggers were given to Detective Tony Roberson, Davidson County and North Carolina Sheriff's Office. And then, Jen, that flows into one of these bombshells, in this case, Leroy Rouse at the grain company, the alibi witness for Patty, who's not a relative, who's not closely connected to her. And Jen, we heard, the listeners heard what Leroy Rouse was told by this individual, Tony Roberson. And Jen, what was your take when you first learned about what I would call witness tampering?
I mean, I don't even know what to make of it. Like, why? Yeah, I have so many thoughts. How does that happen? Why does that happen? What's going on in Davidson County? I mean, the fact that if he came to his door, and asked him to sign something, that coupled with, I mean, I've filed a couple information requests now with Davidson County. Trying to get a copy of Eggers' notes, and I came up empty-handed, and now I'm just looking for any files in general. It's I don't understand it.
Yeah, and Rabia, this kind of brings you full circle, right? Because Rabia, your entry point to this entire space is in the Adnan Syed case. Kevin Yurick telling Asia McClain she's not needed not to come. This, in my
Absolutely.
mind, is even a higher magnitude of misconduct. Are you on the same page, or do you think they're sort of equivalent?
Oh, I think it absolutely is. Because what happened, because what happened is like the tampering happened on both ends here, right? He shows up, he tries to, Roberson lies and says, "We're releasing you, you're not needed." First of all, the state doesn't do that. I mean, he was going to be a defense witness. If anybody's going to release him, it would be the defense, right? Number one. But then on the other end, somebody in this chain of, on the state side told defense counsel. And who's communicating with defense counsel? It's got to be the prosecutor, right? Who else is communicating with defense counsel? Told them that he had a death in the family and cannot come. Now, is it their failure not to contact him independently? 100%. Just like Gutierrez failed contacting Asia. But it's so egregious to me because at every turn they made sure, that Patty was not able to defend herself properly. This is a violation of her due process rights. These are constitutional level violations for me. This is malicious misconduct to me.
And Robbie, beyond what defense counsel was told, okay, there was a death in the family. Obviously, that was a lie, but you can ask for a continuance. You can ask to use Rule of Evidence 804 and have him declared unavailable and get his testimony in under hearsay exceptions. Do we know why? Was there any explanation why defense counsel just didn't do anything when told there was a death in the family?
All right. So the explanation is this. And, I have been thinking kind of like where to, as I said earlier, before we started recording, there's a lot of loose ends that, I have not, I can't pack every single detail into the series because it's just too much to absorb. One of those details is like the really poor defense that Patty got. And the only explanation for why defense counsel didn't do any of this is because they just were not well prepared. This was a death penalty case that they went to trial on in 8 months. In those 8 months, according to what Patty has said, she met with defense counsel 4 times only. And she met with nobody else. Four times. It's not like they were sending paralegals and law clerks and investigators to talk to her. 4 times she met with somebody from her defense team. And she said every time it was about like finances, about how to pay. Like, you know what I mean? And that again reminded me of Gutierrez too, which is like anytime Adnan's family reached out, she's like, the only thing we're going to talk about with you is how you're going to pay the bill. And so the fact that they, and they were not death penalty qualified. So it was an just egregious lack of preparation in the case and yeah, ineffective assistance.
And then from that, Rabia, right, obviously we have the shortcomings of defense counsel. But then as we explain to the listeners this episode, I think we explained a little bit before, but we reiterate it here. And that is that no one knows Walter Trautman. Again, this is the individual who sees the man arguing with the woman in the car. What do you mean it's not mine? Clearly referring to a baby. And we sort of lay out in this episode how Walter Trautman was a complete ghost in the investigation until years later this was uncovered. And Jen, I mean, what is your thought process when you were looking through these files and seeing no one on the defense would have any reason to know about Walter Trautman at the time of trial?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like if that existed and defense didn't know it, I mean, isn't that a Brady? I'm not a lawyer, mm-hmm. but and then just beyond that, like, it doesn't seem like it's just a oversight, but I mean, the fact that his name was like misspelled, his age was given like a full decade off, like on record, one of the officers is said to have like admitted destroying some of the files. I mean, I don't know, from my perspective, like all of that just, yeah, it just boggles the mind, like that somebody could be okay saying, yeah, I destroyed this witness's statement. Like, how is that okay? You know, whether or not he actually saw what he thought he saw, it's pretty significant. And then to destroy statements. Yeah. I don't
those,
get it.
Those statements are destroyed. There's only one statement in the file. And that mm-hmm. is the statement that was written by Egan on the day that he says he had to kick Trautman out, you know, but Trautman's like, that was my fourth time there. And every time I spoke to somebody in front of me, they're taking notes. Like, where's a record of all those visits? And then you've got Egan saying he's been here 15 times harassing us. Where's the evidence? Right? Yeah. Like, so the whole thing is a massive cover up.
Yeah.
That's Brady right there. And yeah, they did go, they went back to court using that as Brady evidence.
And did Egan ever explain why this documentation, including the drawing that Trautman did, why that all was destroyed? Was there any explanation given?
I don't think he's ever testified to that.
Okay. He was never beat to the fire, forced to explain.
No.
Got it. All right. Well, continuing on then with the episode, right, we also have the issue of the fingernails. And specifically this, the one specimen, as we explain in the episode, is not a piece of the fingernail. Instead, it is the entire front end that was torn off. It has a fleshy, bloody material still attached to it on the victim's chest. I mean, Rabia, why do you think at the time this was not sent for testing?
I don't know why initially maybe I'm just misremembering what happened with the testing on the fingernail. I think it came back with some kind of like mixed DNA, mixed blood on it or mixed DNA. Honestly, I can't remember. So I'll hold off on answering that to later, but I can't remember because believe me, the forensic files are very dense and it's very confusing because there were many, many rounds of testing. However, I do know that right off the bat, Jensen, who likes to just leap to conclusions immediately, was like, well, it's not hers and it's not hers. And he did that with the hair too. If they thought for a second that this was Patty's fingernail, that would have been a very valuable piece of evidence. They were positive it wasn't Joe's because Joe had very trim, like, you know, she kept her fingernails. She kept her nails right. Done. Her nails are done. This is not a done nail. This is like a raggedy looking nail. This is kind of a hang nail that had been torn off. I don't know other than it could have been this. I think it was the same thing where they're like, well, we don't think it's, we know it's not Joe's and we don't think it's Patty's either. So they just left it alone, which was the logic for the hair on the hand as well.
Yeah. And then, Jen, right after the fingernail, we discussed this cigarette butt. And I've seen, I don't know if the two of you have seen this, I've seen online people writing, I think it was maybe even an appellate brief by the state, that this cigarette butt was a match for Patty's DNA. Some misreporting, maybe even by the state's argument. I mean, Jen, what is your take on this cigarette butt and why that was not tested for DNA?
I don't know. I haven't seen the reporting that it was a match for you saying you saw that online, like the misinformation about it being matched to her.
Yeah, I think maybe on a Reddit thread.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, no, I haven't
It's
seen
never been
that.
tested. The cigarette
Yeah,
butt has
no.
never been tested.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I am kind of I land where Rabia lands, and like, don't we want to learn the truth? Like, why isn't this? I mean, I know there are budgetary concerns, but for a case of this magnitude and stuff that's like found right near or on physically, you know, the victim in the case of the nail and the hair, like, how do you not test that? How do you not want to know who it
So
belongs to?
just to refresh my memory, I went back and looked real quickly, but I still don't remember the answer on like the actual what happened at the labs back in 95. But on the stand, so in his lab report, Jensen said when he examined the fingernail, he said it is different in grooming and shape and size than the victim's nails. But on the stand, when he was asked about it, he said all fingernail fragments found at the scene belonged to the victim. And defense counsel missed it. They missed it. They did not catch him on that.
Wait, so doesn't that go against the state saying the jury knew that that was not her nail?
Well, they said that about the hair. They said that about the
Oh, they
hair.
didn't stipulate that about the nail. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. We have some listener questions I'm going to move to. Let's go ahead and start here with question by Mike Combs regarding directed verdicts, asking how often do directed verdicts happen? What does it take for them to actually happen? So often we see cases where we wonder how the person was convicted. Why are judges letting these happen? I want to tie that in, Rabia, to a SpeakPipe message we got. And this is by Mimi.
Hey guys, it's Mimi. I have a couple of questions slash thoughts. So I also read Tammy Mall's book. I'm so interested in this case. It's been such a great season, but just one thing throughout the season and also the book is I still don't understand how she was convicted. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Like, you know, you look at cases like Adnan Syed and Scott Peterson, and you think, oh my God, there's no evidence there. How do they get convicted? But a case like this makes it look like those other cases where you thought there was no evidence actually maybe do have some evidence because there's literally zero evidence in this case. Like, of all the cases I've listened to, I feel like this has the least amount of evidence, and any quote unquote evidence is so not compelling at all. So I just am point blank confused about how they convicted. And Colin, I'm kind of wondering if you could take us through, like, maybe what some of the issues have been in her appellate process, because have the attorneys just been bad? Have they been going after the wrong appeals? It just doesn't seem like she should be in jail, any way you look at it. So I'm still really confused because they obviously got this one wrong.
Yeah, and so let me do two things here. So first of all, to address this in terms of a directed verdict, right? Because obviously, yes, there's an absence of evidence of guilt here. To get a directed verdict, that would mean at trial, the defense says, Your Honor, we want a directed verdict. No reasonable juror could find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It is the judge taking the decision out of the jury's hands and not allowing for a jury verdict. And that requires the complete absence of evidence. The court is not going to weigh the credibility or the quality of evidence. If there's some evidence, however weak, that could support guilt, that is enough to deny a motion for a directed verdict. And then in terms of the appeals, I found it. So, Ravi and Jen, this is from an opinion in 2020. And this is by the PCRA court in Patty's case. And they're referencing a prior opinion by the court. Footnote 2 on page 13. Appellant also challenged the accuracy of the record. Specifically, she attacks a previous memorandum wherein this court stated that, quote, Orchid reported that all six seat back hairs belong to appellant and the cigarette butt contained appellant's DNA. The Commonwealth concedes that appellant is correct that Orchid did not test the cigarette butt. However, this inaccuracy had no impact upon her affirmance of the dismissal. I think in this episode, Ravi and Jen, we really lay out why the hair evidence is unreliable. The fact that the court thought and wrote in their opinion that cigarette butt had Patty's DNA, that's huge. That would be the hugest evidence of guilt in this case, and they were completely wrong.
Oh, I forgot about that. It's been a while since I,
Yeah, so Jen, I mean, when you saw that, that this court is saying this cigarette butt had Patty's DNA and that's part of their opinion, what was your take at the time?
yeah, I totally. There's so much. Those piles are so dense. Well, I think part of me, like, maybe I'm naive. I'm just like, so courts can just like get stuff wrong on this. Like, they don't even remember what they've looked at and what they've seen, and they can just put it into the record, and then it's like, that's okay, and like nothing's gonna. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Robbie, what's your take to either seeing this before or hearing this now?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is not the first time we've seen like, a court get actual facts. I've seen this in Non's case. We've seen these different cases. That the issue, and yes, it is an egregious misstatement of fact and misunderstanding by the court. Having said that, even in the absence of that DNA root. You know, the test of the hair with the root and the 100% match. I think that's what they're like. That's why the appellate court, the higher court was like, it kind of doesn't matter because of the other DNA evidence. So whether or not they thought the cigarette butt tied to her, but I mean, it kind of does matter because yes, it does. It just strengthens the case against her. And like, and you know, I didn't even know, Colin, that this is being spread on the internet, that there was also, and this is how it perpetuates, right? Like, yeah. Well, what do you think though?
I mean, for me, it's absolutely huge because even that appeal, and as we discussed this episode, there are questions about chain of custody with the hair. Did they swap in the exemplars they took from Patty and get a false match? It's not as if they collected a cigarette butt from outside Patty's house and that might have been swapped. If this cigarette butt produced Patty's DNA, I mean, that's case closed. That is by far the strongest evidence of guilt, but it's just wrong. The opinion gets it wrong. There was no testing of the cigarette butt. In fact, Patty wanted the testing
She
of it.
wanted the testing. And you know, so I've been talking obviously to Patty and others kind of on her team in the last, couple of days, especially about kind of moving forward. And we're gonna in our season finale is next week. So brace yourself. But there's a lot more in this case that folks can learn, and we'll talk about that too. But about moving forward, what makes sense, right, strategically. And where I am now on any of the physical evidence in the state's custody, I trust none of it. I trust none of it. I trust none of it to be handled properly. I trust none of it not to be deliberately tainted, frankly, even if the cigarette butt got tested years later. I mean, the one thing. Well, okay, we'll talk about this next. We'll talk about this actually next week's episode because I think that, I mean, that's where it belongs. But if they had won, okay, if Patty's team had pursued cigarette butt testing and the court had ordered them to send the cigarette butt to the independent lab or to the state, I do not trust that butt coming back in the condition it was collected in. I just don't. Okay, and so in terms of Mimi's comment, she has no idea. No, but there was evidence, and that was the DNA evidence. I think that, and that's the case that I make, is that she was convicted based, what I think, on DNA evidence at a time when DNA seemed like magic and it was the CSI effect. And it's like, this can't be wrong. It's just too much of a coincidence, right? I think that coupled with the specter of the gun, they're showing a picture of a gun in court, this huge blown up picture of a gun, as if that was her gun. And for a jury that is, and Margaret reported this, Tammy herself, Patty herself has said this, she saw jurors asleep. She saw jurors not paying attention. They're not allowed to take notes. They're rolling their eyes. Even the judge at times was rolling his eyes at some of the defense case. Yeah, I can totally see a jury looking at that and walking away and being like, that was the gun, right? That was the murder weapon, right?
And I've read the voir dire, and there's a person in there, a juror, who literally says, like, he's a scientist, and he's asked about, like, would you give DNA the same weight as, other testimony? And he's like, you're basically gonna have to like prove to me that the DNA was not collected well or not used well. He said, and otherwise he's going to give that like
The most
preference.
weight,
He
the
trusts
most
that. Like,
weight.
he spells it out, and the defense starts to make a motion for cause. I don't know if I'm saying that right, But then the prosecutor asks if he can, you know, I don't know if he's like trying to, is it called rehabilitation or something? Like, he wants to ask him more questions.
Right.
And then I'm not sure what happens exactly. I read it, but I have to read it through again. But somehow they end up both being okay with him. But like the beginning part of it was shocking. I'm like, oh God, like you can see this is the end right here. He's saying like, you're going to, he says the it would be on the defense to prove
the DNA is not reliable.
Yeah, that ties into a speak pipe comment. So we'll have something in a similar vein regarding what the jurors might have been thinking about the forensic evidence.
Hello, Rabia, Colin, and Jin. This is John. I just finished listening to addendum number 9. The discussion at the end was on the judge's decision to keep the trial in the Lehigh Valley Township, or that area, and then his subsequent decision to keep the jury pool from the local area instead of from other places. My question, just understanding the lack of understanding of evidence from the general population in 1998, especially surrounding DNA evidence. If I recall correctly, just based on memory, there were lots of different shows that had been out for quite some time. Law and Order. I think Forensic Files was out by then. You also had classic shows like Murder, She Wrote, Diagnosis Murder, that kind of thing, that probably was telling a false picture of DNA analysis and what could be done. So based on all of that, do you really think, had the jury been composed of other people, maybe outside of the township, would it really have changed anything? Yes, that one jury member that was removed.
And so there's a lot of literature on the so-called CSI effect and differing opinions, but certainly a lot of studies have shown, especially back then, in this period between those forensic TV shows and before a lot of the questions raised about reliability, that jurors essentially accepted lock, stock, and loading barrel this evidence without any question marks. And so, Jen, I think that's kind of the point you're getting at with this juror, right? About when they heard the hair matched Patty, that was pretty much it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a statement from him afterwards, but he's letting the court know beforehand, you know, that like he's going to have to be shown why he shouldn't trust it, you know, by the defense. And yeah, and then I believe, Robbie, you mentioned in an earlier episode that there's statements in the press from a couple of the jurors who did talk saying like that it was, you know, that was a big factor in their decision, correct?
I mean, there were a few jurors that were spoken to that were like, it was kind of a open and shut case before we even started deliberations type of thing. Like, we just didn't even need, like, 20 minutes, we didn't need 20 minutes. And look, here's the thing, you know, but to John's question about, I think that's a interesting thought exercise. Like, would it have even made a difference had they brought in another jury? Because remember at the time, all the evidence that we have that the hair was switched, because I'm not going to say likely switched, maybe switched, that hair was switched. All that evidence that we have was not available at the time. It came out later. The no root memo, you know, Tammy found that. The no RX, Tammy found that. Like, there was, you know, there were discrepancies in, for example, the description of the hair, what the slides looked like, that, you know, maybe the defense could have drilled down on. But the kind of evidence that came out much later that this was not the same hair just didn't exist then. So,
right.
Yeah, maybe what might not have made a big difference to the jury. But, you know, the other thing that Jen's been going through for voir dire has noticed is how many people know each other. The jurors know, like, all these people in the case, right, Jen?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that they didn't always get retained, right? So, but you mean when they're just interviewing the pool of, you know, potential jurors, there's like a person that played golf with somebody's wife and, you know, and then like somebody that, the large majority had definitely heard of the case, you know, at least to some degree. No, there's definitely connections. Like, I'm trying to remember, there was another one that was like really, like, they had worked with one of the co-prosecutors or something. I mean, just stuff like,
yeah. Or family members that know each other. Listen, there's a likelihood that they've got kids that go to school together. They go to churches together. They run into each other in other places. I mean, just because, you know, we know for sure the ones that had the connections and maybe they were struck. But I don't trust fully that the ones who made it through necessarily that we know everything about them. Because, and I'll tell you why. The juror that reached out to me, and I mentioned, you know, what she said. She was the one who got sick suddenly, and she said that she spoke to, and afterwards she was devastated with the verdict. She's like, I wish I was able to be in the deliberations. I would have been a holdout. She spoke to another alternate juror who had sat through the entire trial and also did not agree with the verdict. She was not pulled into the jury, but anyhow, she did not agree with the verdict. And that juror told her, now, of course, this is all like, you know, multiple hearsay, but it's a small town. That juror told her that a couple of jurors went to have like lunch or dinner or had a meal with the families afterwards, the family of the victim. And that could be, I don't know if that means like Andy's family versus Joe's family, but either way, they're both families of the victim. And if that's true, and that they believe that there was some distant familial relationship between them. But you know, we've been trying to dig down into that, if that's the case or not, but it's, you know, we would have avoided that if a jury had been brought in from somewhere else.
Right. Very interesting Facebook comment. This is from Rebecca Mackay. Rebecca Mackay is an award-winning author. She wrote a novel a few years ago that I loved called I Have Some Questions For You about true crime podcasts, very much inspired by Serial and related podcasts. And she wrote, have you seen this? Husband left the baby with his wife after he killed her. And it's a story from Us Magazine, husband of a set designer on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the Amy Sherman Palladino show, stabbed his wife to death and then left the baby with the deceased mother before himself committing suicide. So obviously this bears upon this whole question of what happened with Joe and baby Alex. And so Robbie, had you heard about this case, or were your thoughts about this Marvelous Mrs. Maisel case with leaving the baby with the dead mother?
I had in fact never heard about this case. So thank you, Rebecca, for bringing it to my attention. I don't know if you guys have heard about it, but yeah, I mean, I don't see, you know, I know we've gone back and forth about like, you know, what the profile, who could have done something like this. I see no reason why the father child wouldn't have done this. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like whoever, this was an attack on Joe. This was a targeted, violent, premeditated, maliciously motivated attack on Joe. There's a lot of anger, hate, rage, right? And the baby is, I just think, collateral damage in it. Like, you know, because the baby's an extension of Joe, frankly, for this person. Right. And whoever hated Joe enough to do that is not going to give a crap about the baby. I don't care who did this to her. Like, yeah.
We've mentioned Adnan's case a few times in today's episode. We have a comment by Tawny Zakarian, which also alludes back to it and compares it to this case. She notes, in Tammy's book, it's mentioned there was no soil on the car from where Joe was found. I'm about halfway through the book, but this tidbit has me floored that no one else looked deeper at this at the time. It reminds me of Susan questioning the fresh grass on the tires of Hayes' car. Could the soil have already been naturally removed during the drive from the woods back to the parking lot where it was found? Or was your vehicle used at all to carry this crime out? It probably means little to nothing, but it further shows how poorly the police did to investigate the case properly. Jen, what's your take about the lack of soil in the car from where Joe's body was found?
Yeah, I'd have to go back. I actually saw that comment. It's on my list of things to go back to and review the files to remember exactly the details. I know there were samples taken from a number of different places. And I know also, right, like in our monthly group, you know, we meet with a variety of experts. I've sort of learned through talking with them that like soil, like comparison is not necessarily like there's pretty nuanced, and sometimes you want to look at really specific things. So I think they were mentioning wanting to see like how it had been analyzed, you know, what had been done. I'm not entirely sure what to make of. I would like to hear somebody else look at what they did and then weigh in on it.
Yeah. And then Robbie is sticking with that crime scene. We have Amy Henderson writing, and this is relating back to the comment about how old Alex was when he passed away. Amy writes, hi there, I wanted to follow up about my post regarding the questions about baby Alex's size and age at death. I decided to do more digging online and looked up the medical examiner slash forensic pathologist used in the show Wrong Man, Dr. Catherine Maloney, and called the number. She answered and was extremely kind. She said from her recollection those recordings didn't exist, so she used WHO, World Health Organization, average guideline measurements compared to the autopsy measurements to determine what he might have been closer to 6 months based on his skull size. I told her about the podcast and asked the best way to contact her going forward. She said email is best. Here's the email address. Thanks so much. And so, you know, Ravia, again, this discussion about the age of the child. What's your thought, Ravia, about this medical examiner and what she did?
Yeah, I mean, look, Dr. Maloney did the best of her ability, but there's just no evidence at the time that, you know, anybody who had the forensic pathologist, not that I'm saying that they were so great at it, but that the forensic pathologist found that the baby did not match the size, was egregiously off charts for an almost 16-week-old. I just don't think there's any evidence for it. Yeah. And, you know, I feel like if I find Andy's behavior suspicious, so he is like the suspect who needs to be eliminated at the top. Like, he is like the top suspect who needs to be eliminated, right, before I can move on to anybody else. That's how I'm looking at this. And so if that's the case, where did Andy keep them for months? Right? It's like you have to then think through logistically what it would mean for Joe and the baby to be kept alive, and also why. Yeah. What would be the motive? There's no request. There's no demand for ransom. There's like what? And so none of it, it just doesn't make I just think it's like a red herring, but that's where I'm at on that.
And Rabia, following up with, you know, Andy being your leading suspect, there's a speak pipe message from Ronnie, if we can play that and sort of follow up in that thread.
Hi, Undisclosed Team, Ronnie here. Longtime listener, big fan of the show, big fan of your work. I have one question that I cannot get out of my head about this current case, which is, why would the police protect Andy? What is their motivation for going after Patricia and protecting him from arrest and trial and conviction? I just cannot understand what that is. Okay. What are your thoughts on it? I really want to know. Thank you.
Look, I think what happened here is what we see in a lot of prosecutions, where the prosecutors have to decide who is the most convictable. Who can we make a case against? And you have to remember, we talked about this in the first few episodes. The police were focused on Andy. They were trying, maybe trying poorly, not taking any of it seriously for the first 48 hours, you know, and then not doing a great job really drilling into his alibis. But he was the focus of the investigation. And I think by the time, you know, this kept unfolding and unfolding, they just had locked themselves into, I mean, it wasn't that far in, maybe 2 months in. Within 2 months, folks at the FBI were like, well, I mean, we know he had nothing to do with it. They were saying this on TV. We know he didn't have anything. Because the alibi. They couldn't get around the alibis. Yeah. I don't know. What else do you think Colin might have prevented it other than the alibis?
I mean, you touched upon this earlier of Patty had an abortion. Mm-hmm. People did not characterize her as the typical womanly woman. And this is the type of case where it's very easy for law enforcement, especially at the time, to say this was a jilted, jealous woman who still carried a torch for Andy. They thought was told a couple of days before this murder by Joe not to contact Andy in a very harsh manner. And so the narrative of this jilted, jealous woman is very easy to package and sell to the jury.
Yeah. It just comes down to, I think, who they think they can convict. Mm-hmm. And I think they thought it would be much harder to convict Andy.
Yeah. Both sides, yeah.
Yeah.
Tough to convict Andy, easier to convict Patty. Yeah.
Yeah. Although she was, I mean, again,
it took
a lot of finagling. They had to massage a lot of stuff in this case. They had to tamper with witnesses. They had to do a lot of stuff to make sure that she was not able to defend herself.
Yeah. All right. Last comment for us to address. We did a little in the episode, but let's just be clear on this because a lot of listeners have questions about what could be done now. So Brittany the Color asks, do the hair still exist today or the fingernail? Even if blood/tissue is scraped off the nail, couldn't it still hold some DNA? Were Joe's fingernails collected slash did they get any scrapings from underneath them? Is any of her clothing still in existence today? And so either Jen or Rabia, is there anything out there today that if there were the will and a way could still be tested?
Interestingly enough, as far as I recall, I don't think Joe's fingernails were scraped, which I think is egregious in a case like this. But that one fingernail still exists. The one that was cleaned off, that fingernail still exists, and the cigarette butt still exists, and the hair from the hand still exists. Do I trust any of it? No. Do I think somebody would clip off their fingernail and switch it out? Maybe. I mean, like, I don't. Now, can a fingernail alone without any like kind of blood or flesh or other kind of skin material on it anymore? Because again, all of that was cleaned off. And that requires like a chemical cleaning, not a physical clean, a chemical cleaning. So I believe that there is new DNA technology that can extract DNA from just a nail. I think that does exist. So that is an option. And I feel like a nail might, as long as the chain of custody on that nail is solid,
right?
That nail might be better evidence than, like, say, a cigarette butt, which I think could easily be tainted. But her clothing, yeah, I think the clothing should still exist. Jen, when we went, I don't remember seeing clothing in the exhibits, though.
No, there was photos of the clothing, but the clothing itself was not.
I wonder where that is. It's probably in an evidence locker somewhere.
All right, well, that wraps up our discussion of episode 10 of the Patty Aurora series. Rabia, you mentioned it earlier, but what should the listeners look forward to in episode 11?
Episode 11 is loose ends. It's loose ends and the way forward and having a conversation with Patty as well.
Great. All right, well, Jen, Rabia, thanks so much. And listeners, as always, thanks to you. We will see you back next Monday for episode 11 of The State versus Patricia Aurora.
Thank you, Colin.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Rabia.
If you want even more undisclosed content, remember you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at undisclosedpod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at undisclosedpod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you got to do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, with the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at UndisclosedPod. We want to thank our sponsors and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.